maybe we hang together so well that it's like a whole presentation. Or maybe not. There's some seats in the front here. Actually, the front, you know, it's always the front seems to be the emptiest one. But I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 seats up there. So if you want to squeeze in here, that'll be good. Okay, now for something completely different. integrating economic and public health perspectives. Well, you see in a minute why it's different. It really, you know, no relationships to disclose, and I really have no idea what I would have to do to get a conflict of interest here. I'd be interested, but let me know. So, let's start off with the puzzle here. Why don't well-intended health proposals receive enthusiastic support? And I think Deborah had lots of ideas already. And I think that one of the reasons is changes in diet and physical activity, they transcend public health. Every piece of legislation, regulation, or intervention, it creates winners and losses and losers, and there actually are legitimate interests beyond public health. Let me tell you one of the problems that we, well, advocates ran into. This was actually by now a few years old, the Twinkie Tax story, right? Now, when people made a survey on that, the public really reviles food taxes by a two-thirds majority. This is a margin that is as wide as the approval of cigarette taxes. Now, two-thirds majority, if in politics, if you have a 55 to 45, that's called a landslide, right? Now, a two-thirds majority is otherwise pretty much unheard. So when you have something that is so out of touch with the general perception, industry lobbyists are, well, are they considered upholding common sense, seen as a champion of American values instead of a narrow economic interest group? And yep, there really is that danger here. Heavy-handed proposals invite a backlash, like this one. Now, this is a vile organization. One of you here from consumerfreedom.com. They're pretty nasty, although they really have a lot of talent. They're not used for particular good things, necessarily, but they're talented. And here's sort of this pushback type advertising that they're putting in, which really resonates with the vast majority of Americans. So if you can't see it, you're too stupid to make your own food choices. That's the punchline. Consumerfreedom.com. Actually, check out their website. It is highly entertaining. It can be nauseating, but it is entertaining before you get nauseated. So, here's what I'm going to talk about, the economic versus public health view. I think both play an important role in the policy process. They're often seemingly at loggerheads, right? They're fighting each other. Well, they don't have to, right? It comes about of framing and understanding the other perspectives. Interventions that are supported by both perspectives are most likely to be effective and politically acceptable, and if we want to make any progress, we need things that are effective and politically acceptable. And without understanding the economic perspective, health and public health professionals will have limited influence, and I have seen that plenty of times in state legislative hearings and congressional hearings and other places. Here's the public health view. Well, you know it, right? Intervene if health could be improved. That's nice. Having a single focus is, well, it focuses your attention. You know what you want to do. And it's really expert opinion to evaluate desirable outcomes. Public health view is pretty technocratic, just like medicine is. There comes a limitation with this. If you don't really take into account explicit the role of individual preferences, I'm not talking about one patient's, but well, how is it working out overall in the society? There's no explicit consideration of other trade-offs, which is the problem if you have a single goal. And it often makes you look out of touch with what's going on in the world. And the consumer freedom, they really take advantage of sort of this disconnect. The economic view comes to a totally different perspective, totally different. Health is one of many competing goals, and it's not necessarily rated higher or lower than anything else. It's one of many things that people care about, and you have to make trade-offs. And the people who should make those trade-offs are individuals. Consumer sovereignty over outcomes is a central feature of the U.S. institutional framework, and we have to work in this institutional framework because, well, that's just the society we're in, and it would have been different 40 years ago in the Soviet Union, but that's a different time and a different place. And sort of where the economic, where you can get tractions, where you can get economists and the regulatory framework behind it, if you can identify market failures. Here are things where things don't work like the way they used to do, and if you can use that lingo here about market failures, you're getting somewhere. Externalities under provision of public goods services, information problems are where markets don't work and they don't achieve the goals that will be beneficial. I just told you a central feature of the U.S. institutional framework. I can give you lots of examples. I could just give you one, federal agencies. Right? Federal agencies, they must identify market failures that proposed regulations address. So if you say this organization just should do something, well, you know, tell me what the market failure is. OMB Regulatory Planning and Review, the latest was updated under Bill Clinton. This is the language that came, Bill Clinton signed off on this. Is, you want to promote regulation? First, you got to determine whether there exists a market failure that's likely to be significant. Secondly, you got to distinguish actual market failures from potential market failures that can be resolved at relatively low cost by market participants. No actual market failure, no role for federal regulation. So keep that in mind. That is the constraints we need to work on. Here's a little bit on the internal and external costs to highlight sort of the economic view. Internal costs, economists think about the costs that are borne by individuals and family members themselves that are a consequence of their choices. The external costs, these are costs that are imposed on others, and they're not necessarily financial. Crime, drunk driving, these are external costs. Drunk driving, you drink something, you cause most very likely problems to others. If costs are internal, and here comes the big gap between economics and public health, if costs are internal, should we be concerned? Now, public health advocates would say, yes, because health is compromised. Economists would say, well, probably not, as long as there's no market failure. Externalities cause market failures. That's externalities, a cost benefit of an activity that's imposed on others, not necessarily financial. And in physical activity, it's easier to sort of see where the market is not working the way it should be. The social costs of driving are not reflected in gas or car prices. They are externality here because driving, well, air pollution you get in one case, global warming you have another one. Related physical activity, well, they make walking or biking unpleasant and dangerous. Here's an externality and something that is a problem. The social costs of sprawling environments are not reflected in housing prices or the cost of such developments. San Diego is beautiful. There's a lot of sprawl going on, unfortunately, outside. This morning, if you would have tried to go to this 7-lane freeway coming from the north, it would have been clogged, right? We have a problem here, an externality. That's not reflected in the sprawling developments just a little bit north from here. For smoking, we have externalities to once, and maybe we can see some parallels for diet and physical activity. Smoking bans often would aim to reduce externalities, not just the smokers' health themselves, but the externalities on non-smokers. All that story about secondhand smoke, we didn't know if it was a problem, but it certainly was something to be concerned about because non-smokers did not want to breathe that stuff, regardless of whether it's good or bad for their health. It was a nuisance, an externality. Also, and that could be related to what Deborah is seeing here, on smokers that wanted to quit or reduce smoking because that made it harder for them to quit in smoking. Here's an externality, and maybe in food we have something similar. In dietary patterns, okay, here's something I consider the red herring, which is what when you talk to economists, that's the one thing they get around, and it's not a good one. Oh, because obese people have high healthcare costs, and healthcare costs are partially funded through insurance, we have externalities. I don't think that's a big deal here. The main burden of poor health is really borne by individuals. We should only consider the external costs from collectively financed healthcare disability payments. That's a small stuff. That's not getting us anywhere. What nobody really, as far as I know, at least I haven't seen it, has thought through sort of from the economic perspective, and it's potentially more important, is that several of the issues that Deborah alluded to, the unconscious influences from other people's behavior, that is, see the relationship to smoking, right? Smokers who wanted to quit. Environmental cues that raise the costs for individuals to adhere to rational decisions. Now, there are some economists that say, oh, it's all purely rational decisions. Most of them don't. Because we know there is a cost to it if you have to consciously control your eating, your activity, right? If you have to think about it, that's a cost to you. It can be a pretty substantial cost, but it's definitely a cost. And if there's an externality from a few cues, well, maybe we're getting somewhere here. The other market failure is the public goods stories. Nobody can be excluded from public goods services. I see here traction again for physical activity, that whether neighborhoods are safe and pleasant for walking, biking to school, store, work, parks in good condition, accessible. There's no good private substitutes for safety, sidewalks, and public facilities. Really, there isn't. That doesn't mean markets can never work. Markets work quite well for a private good like gyms. But, you know, gyms is not the solution to a lack of physical activity opportunities. For diet, I don't quite see the action, with one exception here. If Deborah is right, maybe what we need is important counter-advertising areas in environmental cues that really counter the things that make us eat, and that would be a public good. In any event, we need a better integration of the new insights from psychology and marketing with economics, and I'm not sure if this section is getting very far here, but at least we're trying. I mean, we have very different perspectives, certainly Deborah and I, but then Brian is a psychologist, and so we all come from different angles. And we see something, but it's maybe we can get it to gel eventually. Information problems is the one where economics clearly can say, yes, we need to do something. If critical information is missing, low-quality products dominate the market, even if consumers prefer high-quality products. That's not new. This type of market failure is well-known to economists since Nobel laureate George Akerlof's Lemon paper. His story here was in the used car market. Well, people want to buy and sell used cars, but if you don't really know what you're getting when you're buying it, but a seller knows very well what's happening, the good cars stay off the market because the seller will keep them because they don't get the price they want. And you have a lemon market. You only have junky cars on the used car market. An information problem, information asymmetry. And I believe we have that in the food certainly for food away from home, dramatically. So when informational problems are sufficiently severe, regulation is needed for an efficiently working market. That's why we have disclosure regulations for real estate, cars, lots of areas. We need a lot of that more in food. And that especially affects eating out. Oh, I still have 5 minutes. Oh, I'm rushing. Okay, let's slow down. The information and eating out. Without information about nutritional content at the point of consumption, competition is on the dimensions that consumer can evaluate easily, which is price, amount, and taste. And during a time when food was scarce, well, probably that's about all you really needed to know. That's not the environment we're in now. Well, there could be a market failure. If food away from home, let's think about it, had the same average nutritional densities as food at home in 1995, Americans would have consumed 197 fewer calories per day and reduced their fat intake to 31.5%. That's for a USDA calculation. And, well, usually I know who the authors are, but I'm blanking on it right now. Anyway, it's not a new study. Now, what do we draw from this conclusion? Are people just going out to eat badly and to eat more? Not really, right? You want nice food, and nice food doesn't mean it has to be a lot more and a lot fatter and healthier, greasier. So something is not working well. And I think the menu labeling story is fully consistent with standard economic theory. Now, you all know that people will not read labels. Of course they won't. Most people will not read labels. Most will not understand it. That's sort of the story about education, why the education programs don't really work. That's not an issue. You don't need everybody to read labels. You don't need the majority to read labels. A small minority is good enough to really change the market incentives here. A small shift in consumption patterns, even if it's only 10% all of a sudden change what they want to buy, it alters the profitability. It leads to large market shifts. Different type of restaurants will come up because all of a sudden now they can sell the products that before they were squeezed out of. It's not necessary that most people react to new information. But one thing that's definitely not going to work is it's hard to see how markets could work efficiently in the absence of key information about food. And the key information is food away from home, some nutritional information. So let me get to the summary here. Economics is concerned with the distribution of cost benefits. That's an important complement to the public health view, and you should keep that in mind if you're dealing with policy issues. Neither one is by itself is true all the time. You often, certainly in the health area, you often have a jump to the complete opposite FDA in particular, where economics then sometimes is completely out of the picture. But most of the time, if we can integrate them, we'll do better. Market failures are necessary to justify interventions when you want to support an economic perspective. Externalities and underprovision of public goods may be market failures that reduce physical activity below socially optimal levels. I think I see some clear pieces here. I don't see them for dietary food yet. So I would say we're unclear here about the role of externalities in dietary patterns. The story of environmental cues and other people's behavior. Now, Deborah showed you a few things. The quality of that evidence is very mixed. Let's put it this way, right? There is something to it, but what it is, I'm not really sure yet. Maybe Brian can, who actually does these type of experiments, can tell you a little more about this. Information problems are most obvious for food away from home, and I think here's a policy part, and Tom will tell you about what they do in New York, the menu labeling. I think this is addressing a real market failure. My conclusion here would be, one, we need to integrate new insight from psychology and economics. The current perspectives are too narrow, and there are a good number of economists who are still too single-minded still about a somewhat outdated ideology. But again, that's probably the minority of economists. Secondly, one take-off point. Interventions will be most... Why do I say may? Let me strengthen that to will be most successful and politically sustainable when public health and economic perspectives coincide. And if we can integrate that, rather than saying, oh, they fight each other, we'll get some traction in the policy world. Thank you.
And the next speaker is Tom Farley from Tulane.